had earlier seemed to rise in her esophagus. Swallowing against the nausea, she forced herself to ask, "Is it Mr. Ransom?" "Yes." More sharp spikes were driven into her chest, pinning her pounding heart in place. She felt her face contorting, spasming. Ravenel spoke with measured slowness, trying to give her time to absorb the information. "There's a bullet in his chest. He's lost a great deal of blood. The wound doesn't seem to be bleeding now, but his condition is very bad. He goes in and out of consciousness. We sent for you not out of any hope that you could heal him, but because he wanted to see you one last time." Garrett tried to think above a flood of sick horror. She wanted to scream, weep, collapse. But as she thought of the men who were responsible for harming him, a bolt of fury engulfed her, searing through the smothering despair. How dare they do this to him? The burst of rage steadied her and gave her strength. Her fist tightened around the handles of her leather bag. "Show me to him," she heard herself say in a level voice. "I'll fix him." Chapter 16. "I don't think you understand the severity of his condition," Ravenel said as he led the way to the double library. "He's hanging by a thread."
"I understand his condition quite well," Garrett said, proceeding along the hallway with heel-digging strides. "Any perforating wound of the chest is life-threatening. Furthermore, the Thames is contaminated with bacteria, nitrates, and poisonous chemicals. One can hardly do enough to disinfect him."
"But do you think there's a chance of saving him?" he asked, skeptically.
"I will save him."
Garrett gave an impatient shake of her head as she heard the quaver in her voice. They entered the library, two spacious joined rooms lined with acres of mahogany bookshelves. The interior was arranged with a few pieces of stately heavy furniture, including a massive table running along the centre and a long, low settee. An expanse of sodden Persian carpeting was heaped with toweling and cans of water. A foul scent competed with the acrid freshness of carbolic soap, commonly used for horses and difficult household cleaning. The small, slim form of Kathleen, Lady Trenere, and the far more substantial one of her husband, Devon, were bent over a still form laid out on the settee. Garrett's heartbeat was so rough that the lights in the room seemed to pulse in front of her eyes. "Good evening," she said, trying to sound composed without success. Both of them turned toward her. Kathleen, a red-haired woman with delicate, almost feline beauty, regarded her with concern.
"Dr. Gibson," she murmured.
"Countess," she said distractedly, and gave a cursory nod to the tall, dark-haired Earl.
"Lord Trenere,"
her gaze went to Ethan. If not for the continuous trembling that shook Ethan's long frame, she would have assumed he was already dead. His complexion was waxen, his lips blue-tinged, his eyes closed and sunken. They had covered his body with a quilt, but had left his shoulders and one arm bare. His hand lay palm upward, with the fingers slightly curled, the nails lavender grey. Setting down her doctor's bag, Garrett knelt on a folded towel beside the settee and reached for his wrist to check his pulse. It was nearly too weak to detect. His veins were colourless and flattened. Oh, God! He'd lost too much blood. Anything she did was going to kill him. Ethan jerked a little at her touch. The thick lashes lifted to reveal a flash of unearthly blue. His disoriented gaze settled on her, focusing with effort. A faint smile ghosted across his lips.
"Garrett, my time's run short."
"Nonsense," she said firmly. "I'll have you back to rights quite soon."
She began to pull back the quilt, but his big, cold hand slid over hers, stopping her.
"I'm dying, love," she heard him whisper.
The word shook Garrett by the spine, as nothing ever had before. She was distantly amazed that she could manage a coherent reply.
"I thank you to leave the diagnosing to me."
His fingers wrapped around hers. The feel of them was unfamiliar, devoid of their natural heat and strength.
"Garrett."
She used her free hand to ease the quilt down until a bullet wound was visible. It was a surprisingly neat, small circle. Given the elasticity of skin, the bullet was undoubtedly larger than the hole's diameter. Ethan's gaze fixed on hers as he spoke with effort.
The first moment I saw you, I knew you were my share of the world. I've always loved you. If I could choose my fate, I'd never be parted from you. Akushla, pulse of my heart, breath of my soul. There's nothing on this earth more fair and fine than you. Your shadow on the ground is sunlight to me.
He fell silent, his eyes closing. Tremors racked his body. Pain drew his eyebrows together as if he were concentrating very hard on something. Clumsily, Garrett drew away from him to rummage in her bag, yanking out a stethoscope. Her heart was dashing itself to pieces. She wanted to throw herself on him and howl in despair. "I'm not strong enough for this," she thought. "I can't bear it. God, please don't let this happen. Please." But as she looked down at Ethan's ashen face, a mantle of calm determination settled over the blaze of anguish. She would not lose him. Carefully, she set the stethoscope at various points on his chest, from just above his collarbone down to the bottom of his ribcage. Although his breathing was far too rapid and shallow, his lungs didn't appear to have been damaged. Clinging to that one small bit of good news, she reached into her supplies, found her hypodermic needle case, and prepared a syringe of morphine. "Ethan," she asked quietly, "can you tell me what kind of gun it was? Did you see how far away the shooter was standing?" His eyes slitted open, staring at her without comprehension. "Devon," Lord Trinneer answered from behind her. "From the powder burns, it appears he was shot at point-blank range. There's no exit wound. I would guess it was a large-caliber round shot at low velocity." She hoped he was right. The inward track of a heavy bullet through the flesh would be wider, which would make probing and removal easier.
"He said it was one of Jenkins's men," Trinneer continued. "A professional assassin would use one of the more modern bullets with a conical shape instead of a round. If so, it would be partially encased in a shell of copper or steel."
"Thank you, my lord." A pointed tip made it likely the bullet had pursued a direct course instead of bouncing and ricocheting inside him, and if the projectile was covered by a hard casing, the lead wouldn't have fragmented. Trinneer gave her an astute glance, understanding that she was going to operate on Ethan right there in a last-minute attempt to save his life. His eyes were dark blue rimmed with black. Ethan's eyes. Was she going mad? No, she wouldn't think about anything except the work that awaited her. "What do you need?" Kathleen asked, coming to stand beside her. "We have 3 large cans of boiled water, and more in the process of heating. We've been using it to wash him with carbolic soap."
"Excellent," Garrett said.
"The footman has carried in a basket of surgical chemicals. If you would, my lady, please find the one labelled sodium hydrochlorite, and pour the entire contents into one of the cans of water. Use that to disinfect every inch of the library table, and cover the surface with clean linen sheets. We'll need as many lamps in there as you're able to provide." She turned to Devon. "My lord, can you send someone to fetch Dr. Havelock?"
"I'll fetch him myself."
"Thank you. Also, make certain he brings the Russell transfuser. He won't want to, but don't let him come without it." Continuing to kneel beside the settee, Garrett swabbed Ethan's upper arm with antiseptic solution. Tilting the morphine syringe upward, she expertly forced the air from the small glass chamber until a clear drop appeared at the tip of the hollow needle. Ethan stirred and blinked, seeming to regain his sensibilities.
"Garrett," he said carefully,
as if he knew her but wasn't quite sure of the name. His gaze flickered to the hypodermic needle in her hand.
"Don't need that."
"You'll be glad of it when I start probing for the bullet." His chest rose and fell with an agitated breath.
"Don't even think about opening me up like a tin of boiled ham."
"You're going to receive proper medical treatment," she informed him.
"If I made it through surgery, the fever would kill me."
"You will make it through surgery, and you will definitely have fever, a nasty one. After being doused in that filthy river, you're teeming with inflammatory microbes. Fortunately, I brought a variety of antiseptic solutions. Before long, I'll have you clean as a bobbin."
"For God's sake, woman. Ah, damn it!" What is that?
Morphine, she said, depressing the plunger slowly to release the medicine into the thick muscle of his upper arm. Ethan subsided, realizing there would be no stopping her.
You haven't one romantic bone in your body, he muttered.
That sounded so much like his usual self that Garrett almost smiled. I reassembled an entire disarticulated skeleton in medical school. There's no such thing as a romantic bone. He turned his face away from her. Garrett was wrenched with love and agonized concern. She felt her lips tremble, and she clamped them shut. She knew Ethan understood how close to death he was, and had resigned himself to what he thought was inevitable. He wanted to spend the last few minutes of his life, lucid and aware, in the arms of the woman he loved. But instead of caressing him, her hands would be plying surgical instruments. Instead of gazing at him adoringly, she would be examining inner contusions and lacerations. No, her way was not romantic. She wouldn't be the woman he loved, however, if she didn't use all her skills in an effort to save him. Setting aside the hypodermic syringe, Garrett looked down at the perfect shape of his ear. She bent to rub her lips softly against the lobe.
"Iatan," she whispered, "listen to me. This is what I do. I'll bring you through this and take care of you. I'll be with you every minute. Trust me."
His cheek nudged back toward her. He saw that he didn't believe her. All the light in his eyes had vanished, save a last glint or two, like the ember of a candlewick that had just been snuffed.
"Tell me you love me," he whispered.
Panicked words fluttered and darted inside her. "I love you. I need you. Oh, God, please stay with me." But she had the terrifying premonition that saying it would allow him to let go, as if she would be giving him permission to pass away peacefully, instead of fighting for his life.
"Later," she said gently.
"When you wake up after the surgery, I'll tell you." By the time Dr. Havelock had arrived, Ethan had been transferred to the massive oak library table. It had taken the combined efforts of West Ravenel and three footmen to move him as carefully as possible, in a fear of dislodging possible bone shards or lead fragments or causing other damage. Ethan had slipped into a delirium, only letting out an occasional groan or wordless exclamation. With Kathleen's help, Garrett had wiped Ethan's form from head to toe with a disinfectant solution and shaved around the gunshot wound in preparation for surgery. They had draped a towel across his hips for modesty and covered him with clean cotton blankets afterward. A blue-white pallor gave his flesh the illusion of cool marble perfection, sculpted and polished to a silky sheen. It was somehow worse to see a man of such robust health reduced to this condition. The morphine had taken what effect it would, but Ethan was still in obvious pain, and Garrett didn't dare give him any more with his blood pressure so low. Garrett had never been so relieved as she was when Dr. Havelock arrived. His capable presence made her feel that together they would pull Ethan through. Havelock's distinctive shock of snow-white hair had been brushed back hastily, his cheeks and chin glinting with a day's growth of silver beard. He examined Ethan with quiet efficiency, responding to the wounded man's incoherent murmurs with a few soothing words. When Havelock had finished his evaluation, Garrett went with him to the far end of the library for a private conference.
"He's on the verge of circulatory collapse," Havelock said quietly, his expression grave. "In fact, I've never seen a patient with a capacity to endure such severe hemorrhage. The bullet penetrated the left pectoral muscle. I wouldn't be surprised if an artery has been completely severed."
"That's what I thought. But if so, it should have been immediately fatal. Why has the bleeding stopped? If it were leaking into the chest cavity, his lung function would be impaired, but it isn't."
"It's possible the artery has constricted and retracted within its sheath, thereby sealing itself temporarily."
"If it turns out to be the axillary artery, would there be enough blood supply left for the arm if I tie it off?"
"Yes, there would be sufficient collateral circulation, but I wouldn't advise it."
"What would you advise, then?" Havelock regarded her for a long moment, his gaze kind in a way she didn't like.
"Make the poor fellow as comfortable as you can, and let him die in peace."
The words were a slap in the face. "What?" Garrett asked, dazedly. "No!
I'm going to save him.
You can't. Based on everything you've taught me about antiseptic medicine, this man is so contaminated within and without, there's no hope. Subjecting him to unnecessary surgery is folly and selfishness. If we did manage to delay his death for a day or so, he would go through unspeakable agony. His entire body would become riddled with sepsis until all his organs failed. I won't have that on my conscience, and I don't want it on yours.
Let me worry about my own conscience. Just help me, Havelock. I can't do this by myself.
Operating, when the medical facts don't warrant it, when it will only cause the patient needless suffering, that is malpractice by any standard.
I don't care, Garrett said recklessly.
You'll care very much if this destroys your career. You know there are many who would leap at the chance to revoke your medical license, the first female physician in England, driven out of the profession because of scandal and misconduct. What would that do to the women who dream of following in your footsteps? And what about the patients you'll never be able to help in the future?
If I do nothing for this man, I'll never be of use to anyone, Garrett burst out, trembling from the force of her emotions. It would haunt me forever. I couldn't live with the thought that there was a chance to save him, but I didn't take it. You don't know him. If our positions were reversed, he would do anything for me. I have to fight for him. I have to. The older man stared at her as if he didn't recognize her.
You're not thinking clearly.
I'm thinking more clearly than I ever have in my life.
This is the man you met at Lord Tatham's house last evening.
Garrett flushed but held his gaze as she admitted, "He and I were already acquainted. He's important to me."
"I see."
Havelock was silent then, stroking his white whiskers, while precious seconds of Ethan's life ticked away. "Did you bring the transfuser?" Garrett burst out, impatient to decide on a course of action. Havelock looked grim.
"I've attempted blood transfusion on 7 different occasions, and every case but one ended in shock, pain, and stroke or heart failure. No one has yet discovered why some blood is compatible and some isn't. You haven't seen what happens when the procedure fails. I have. Never again will I knowingly inflict such agony on a patient."
"Did you bring it?" she persisted.
"I did," he grated. "God help you and that poor wretch if you try to use it. Be honest, Dr. Gibson. Are you acting on behalf of your patient or yourself?"
"Both of us. I'm doing it for both of us." She saw from his expression that it was the wrong answer.
"I can't help you to do something against your own interests as well as his," Havelock said. "This is madness, Garrett."
He never used her first name. As she stood there in stricken silence, he gave her a look that was somehow both pleading and stern before departing the library. "You're leaving?" she asked in bewilderment. He continued past the threshold without replying. Garrett felt hollow and numb. Dr. William Havelock, her partner, advisor, supporter, and confidant, a man with the unfailing ability to discern right from wrong, even in the most complex situations, had just walked out on her. He would take no part in what she was doing, not because he was wrong, but because she was. He was sticking to principles, whereas she had no principles when it came to Ethan Ransom. She only loved him. Shaken, despairing, she blinked against a burning wet blur. She was choking on her own breath. "Damn it! Damn it!" Now she was crying. Someone was standing at the doorway. It was West Ravenel, leaning a broad shoulder against the jamb, his gaze level and appraising. His blue eyes were startling against the sun-browned richness of his complexion. Garrett lowered her head, swallowing repeatedly against the needling pain in her throat. She had no defences left. He must have contempt for her, or pity, and either way, one word from him would destroy her.
"Go on, and take a crack at it," she heard Ravenel say casually. "I'll help you."
Her head bobbed upward. She stared at him, dumbfounded. It took her a moment to realise he was offering to assist with the surgery. After clearing her throat twice, the clenched muscles loosened enough for her to speak. "Do you have any medical training?"
"Not a bit. But I'll do whatever you tell me."
"Do you have any problems with the sight of blood?"
"Lord, now, I'm a farmer.
I'm around blood all the time, both animal and human.
Garrett regarded him dubiously, blotting her cheeks with the edge of her sleeve. There's that much blood involved in farming?
Ravenel grinned. I didn't say I was any good at it.
The flash of his smile was so oddly like Ethan's that Garrett felt a sharp pang in her chest. Tugging a handkerchief from inside his coat, he came forward to give it to her. Mortified for him to have seen her crying, Garrett wiped her cheeks and eyes and blew her nose.
How much did you hear?
Most of it. Sound carries all through this library.
Do you think Havelock was right?
About which part?
That I should make Mr. Ransom comfortable during his last few minutes on Earth, instead of torturing him with surgery?
No, you've already managed to ruin a moving deathbed scene. I couldn't wait to hear what came after, your shadow on the ground as sunlight to me, but then you started giving orders like a drill sergeant. You might as well operate on Ransom. We won't get any more good lines out of him tonight.
Garrett stared at him with a bewildered frown. The man either didn't know or didn't care how inappropriate it was to joke in these circumstances. She suspected it was the latter. On the other hand, she found his cool insouciance rather reassuring. She sensed he could be a bit of a bastard when it suited him, not at all the kind who would fall apart under pressure, and at the moment, that was exactly what she needed.
All right, she said. Go to the kitchen and wash the upper half of your body with carbolic soap and hot water. Make certain to scrub beneath your fingernails.
She looked down at his hands, which were elegantly long-fingered and scrupulously clean. The nails were pared nearly down to the quick, with only the thinnest possible white crescents showing.
"What should I wear?" Ravenel asked.
"A bleached linen or cotton shirt. Don't touch anything afterward, especially not tables or doorknobs, and come back here directly."
He gave her a short nod and strode away with a confident stride. His voice could be heard in the hallway.
"Mrs. Abbott, I'm going to the kitchen to wash. You'll want to warn the housemaids to shield their eyes from the sight of my manly torso."
Kathleen, Lady Trenere, came to Garrett.
"Whose housemaids would he be referring to?" she asked dryly.
"Ours will be crowding into the scullery to obtain the best possible view."
"Is he reliable?"
Garrett asked. "Solid as a rock. West manages the estate farms and leaseholds, and has experience at everything from spring lambing to tending sick livestock. He can handle anything, no matter how revolting. And I'm usually like that also, but—" Kathleen paused and looked chagrined. "I'm with child again, and I'm queasy most of the time." Garrett looked at the Countess with concern, seeing that she was clammy and ashen and visibly unsteady. The foul smell of polluted water must have made her wretched.
"It's not good for you to be exposed to this contamination," she said. "You must bathe at once and lie down in a well-ventilated room. Also, have your cook make fresh tea with fresh ginger root. That will help to settle your stomach."
"I will." Kathleen smiled at her. "You'll have West and the servants to help you. My husband will be making arrangements for Mr. Ransom to be spirited away from London as soon as possible. He must be taken to a safe place until he's well again."
"I fear you may have rather too much faith in my abilities," Garrett said grimly. "After the surgery you performed on Pandora, there's no doubt in any of our minds that you have miracles up your sleeves."
"Thank you." To Garrett's annoyance, her eyes began to water again. Kathleen's small hands came to hers and gripped them warmly.
"Do your best, and let fate take its course. You can't blame yourself for the outcome if you know you did everything you could."
Garrett managed a wobbly smile.
"Forgive me, my lady, but you don't know much about doctors."
"Artery forceps," Garrett said, pointing in turn to the gleaming, sterilized instruments on a linen-covered tray.
"Torsion forceps, wound forceps, suture forceps, amputating knife, double-edged amputating knife, Catlin knife, resection knife, middle-pointed scalpel, curved scalpel, straight and curved scissors."
"You'll have to tell me as we go along. My mind went blank after amputating knife."
West Ravenel stood beside Garrett at the library table, where Ethan's unconscious form was draped in clean white sheets and a cotton blanket. Garrett had administered chloroform by careful drops into a cylindrical inhaler filled with sterilized lint, while Ravenel had held a nose and mouthpiece attached to a length of silk-covered tubing over Ethan's face.
Carefully, Garrett folded back the sheets to expose the sinewed, powerfully honed shape of his torso down to his navel.
"What a specimen," she heard Ravenel say flippantly. "He has muscles in places I didn't know there were muscles."
"Mr. Ravenel," Garrett said, picking up a large irrigator syringe, "please keep your remarks to a minimum." Carefully, she flushed out the wound with a chloride of zinc solution and set the syringe aside. "Hand me the Nelatron probe, the one tipped with unglazed porcelain." After inserting the probe, she discovered the bullet's path was a straight track, running at a slight upward slant towards the outer border of the first rib. The probe's tip tapped against something hard. Garrett withdrew the probe and regarded the blue mark on the end.
"What is that?" Ravenel asked.
"The porcelain turns blue when it comes into contact with lead." The bullet had ended up in an area rich with major veins, arteries, and nerves, all protected by an abundance of tough, unyielding muscle. Garrett had been taught in medical school never to operate on a family relation or someone with whom she had an emotional attachment. A surgeon needed objectivity. But as she looked at Ethan's still face, she realized she was about to begin one of the most difficult procedures of her career on a man she'd fallen in love with. "God help me," she thought, not as blasphemy, but as prayer. "I need the scalpel with the curved edge," she said. Ravenel gingerly handed the instrument to her. As she prepared to make an incision just beneath the clavicle bone, she heard him ask,
"Do I have to watch this part?"
"I would prefer that you hand me the correct instrument when I ask for it," she said crisply, "which would require keeping your eyes open."
"Just asking," he said. "They're open."
She cut down carefully, dividing fibrous tissue and fascia, and clamped the edges of the incision. The bullet was lodged in the axillary artery, along with what appeared to be a bit of woven fabric from a shirt or waistcoat. As Havelock had suspected, the ends of the severed artery had contracted and sealed inside its sheath. The other side was blocked by the lead slug. "He should have bled to death within minutes," she murmured. "But the bullet has temporarily occluded the artery. That, along with coagulum, is acting as a plug." Still staring intently at the wound, she asked, "Can you thread a needle?"
"Yes."
"Good. Use a pair of forceps to remove a catgut ligature from that bottle and use it to thread the thinnest needle on the tray." She positioned Ethan's arm farther upward to form a right angle with his chest. As Ravenel saw where she was preparing to make a second incision, he asked,
"Why are you going to cut near his armpit when the wound is on his chest?"
"I need to tie off the distal end of the artery first. Please let me concentrate."
"Sorry. I'm used to operations on farm animals. If he were a plague-ridden cow, I would understand exactly what was happening."
"Mr. Ravenel, if you don't stop talking, I will chloroform you and do this by myself."
He shut his mouth obligingly.
For the next several minutes, Garrett performed the delicate work of ligating the artery in two places, taking care not to damage the network of nerves and veins in the axillary region. She removed the bullet and the bit of cloth, debrided the damaged tissue, and irrigated the wound to flush out debris and bacteria. At her direction, Ravenel used a curette to freshen the exposed incisions with antiseptic solution. She installed rubber drainage tubes, painstakingly stitched them in place with carbolized silk, and dressed the wounds with boracic gauze.
"Are we finished?" Ravenel asked.
Garrett was too occupied with evaluating Ethan's condition to reply immediately. His knees and feet had acquired a mottled appearance, and his countenance was deathly white. His pulse had fallen to 40 beats per minute. He was sinking.
"Not yet," she said,
trying to think herself into calmness. Her insides were roiling. We need someone else. One person to donate blood and the other to assist me. The Russell apparatus, where is it?"
"You're talking about a blood transfusion?" Ravenel asked. "Does that usually work?"
She didn't look at him as she replied flatly. "At least half the cases die within an hour." Lord Trinneer's quiet voice came from the corner of the room.
"I have the apparatus right here."
Garrett hadn't realized he'd been watching the operation. She'd been too intent on her work to notice his arrival. Coming forward, Trinneer set a gleaming rosewood case on the library table.
"What can I do?"
he asked. Open the case, but don't touch anything inside it. I need one of you to donate the blood, and the other to help with the transfuser.
Take my blood, the Earl said readily.
No,
Ravenel said.
I insist on being the donor. If he lives, it will annoy him far more.
He smiled slightly as his gaze met Garrett's. Something about his presence was so relaxed and steady that it smoothed the edges of her panic.
Very well.
She took a measured breath. Lord Trenere, please wash your hands in the basin on the other side of the table and douse them with carbolic solution. Mr. Ravenel, remove your shirt and sit on the table so that your left arm is positioned next to Mr. Ransom's right one. The transfuser was already sterilized. It was a strange-looking device, a collection of delicate, unvulcanized rubber tubes sprouting from a rigid cupping glass, like a mechanical sea creature. One tube was connected to a water aspirator, another to a tiny junction cap, and a cannula with a needle, and another to a balloon pump regulator. The unwieldy mass shook a little in Garrett's hands as she lifted it carefully from the case. Although she had assisted in a transfusion once, the operating surgeon had used a far simpler and more old-fashioned apparatus. If only Havelock had stayed, damn him, and given her some advice about how this contraption worked. As Garrett looked up from the transfuser, she blinked at the sight of a shirtless West Ravenel hoisting himself easily onto the table. Despite his earlier crack about Ethan's athletic form, he was certainly no physical lightweight himself. He had the hard, rippling musculature of a man accustomed to lifting and carrying heavy weight. But what had surprised Garrett was the discovery that his torso was tanned the same shade of golden brown as his face. All over. What kind of gentleman went outside in the sun for that long with no shirt? Ravenel's lips quirked as he saw her expression. A twinkle of arrogant amusement appeared in his eyes.
Farm work, he said in a matter-of-fact tone. And I do some quarrying.
Half-naked?
Garrett asked tartly, setting the transfuser on an expanse of clean linen.
I've been loading rock into horse carts, he said, which suits my intellectual capacity perfectly, but it's too hot for a shirt.
Although Garrett didn't smile, she appreciated the touch of humour, which helped to stave off an attack of nerves. One mistake, an air bubble in the vein, would finish Ethan off in short order. The Earl came to her.
"What now?" he asked.
She handed him a sterilized glass vessel. "Fill this with boiled water." While the Earl attended to the task, Garrett listened to Ravenel's heart with a stethoscope and checked his pulse. He had the heart of an ox, the rhythm strong and regular. She filled the water aspirator of the transfuser and tied a length of surgical bandage firmly around the thick muscle of his upper arm. "Make a fist, please." His brawny forearm flexed. "A perfect median basilic," she said, swabbing the inside of his arm with isopropyl alcohol. "I could find it without even tying a band around your arm."
"I would preen and bask in your admiration of my vein," Ravenel said, "if I didn't see that 3-inch needle attached to one of those tubes."
"I'll be as gentle as possible," she said, "but I'm afraid it will be uncomfortable."
"Compared to a bullet in the chest, I suppose one can't complain without sounding like a milksop."
His older brother told him kindly, "We all know you're a milksop. Go ahead and complain."
"You may wish to look away, Mr. Ravenel," Garrett murmured, "and keep making a fist.
Call me West."
"I don't know you well enough for that."
"You're draining the life essence from my median basilic," he pointed out. "I'm on a first-name basis with women who've done far less to me than that. Son of a bitch!"
The profanity burst out as he felt Garrett ease the hollow, curved needle into his vein. He frowned down at the sight of his blood running along the rubber tube into the aspirator.
"How much of this is he going to need?"
"Probably no more than 10 ounces. We'll replenish his vessels just enough to restore his pulse to its normal rate and volume."
Garrett tied a band around Ethan's lax upper arm and hunted for a vein. None were visible.
"Lord Trenere, if you would help me by applying pressure to his arm here and here."
The Earl clamped his fingers on the places she had indicated. Nothing. No vein. No pulse. Ethan's last breath escaped in a sigh. He was gone.
"No, you don't!"
Garrett said fiercely.
swabbing his arm and picking up a scalpel. "You're bloody well not going to do this to me, you sow-buggering bastard!" Deftly pinching a fold of cool skin, she made a quick incision to expose a depleted vein. "Hand me the director," she said through gritted teeth. As Trinneer hesitated over the tray of instruments, she snapped, "The pointy one!" Immediately he picked it up and handed it over to her. Within seconds, Garrett had lifted the vein with the director, made a transverse cut with a scalpel, and inserted a cannula. While Lord Trinneer held the cannula in place, she connected it with a transfuser and used the pumps and aspirator to withdraw every dram of air in the line and flush it with sterile water. Although she had never used this kind of transfuser before, her hands somehow knew what to do, guided by a part of her brain that was thinking 10 times faster than usual. A twist of a silver stopcock, and blood began to flow into the vein. The two men were now connected by a hermetically sealed channel. Garrett exerted pressure on the balloon pump to release the blood into Ethan's arm at a slow pace, to keep from overwhelming the heart. Her lips moved in a ceaseless incantation. "Come back, come back, come back." After 1 minute had passed, a miraculous change came over the lifeless form. His pulse resumed. His colour rose rapidly. His chest lifted once, twice, and he began to breathe in deep, fitful gasps. Another minute, and he was perspiring and twitching. Garrett let out a sigh of relief that sounded embarrassingly like a whimper. Feeling her eyes brim, she covered them with one hand and fought for self-control. A few profane words escaped her lips as a tear slid down to her chin. "You curse so beautifully," she heard Ravenel say dryly. "Few women can do it with such natural ease."
"I learned at the Sorbonne," Garrett said, with her hand still over her eyes. "You should hear me curse in French."
"I'd rather not, or I might fall in love with you. By the way, does Ransom have enough blood now? Because I'm starting to feel a bit light-headed."
After Garrett had cleaned her instruments and the transfuser equipment, she checked Ethan's vital signs for the 10th time. Pulse 100, temperature 99, respirations 30. He was sweating profusely and stirring uneasily as the effects of anaesthesia slowly faded. Leaving him in the care of Mrs. Abbott, Garrett unsteadily made her way to a corner of the library and sat on a small, carved stepladder. Bending forward, she rested her head on her knees. She was distantly aware that she was shaking as if from a seizure. She couldn't think what to do about it, only crouched there and quivered until her teeth rattled. Someone was beside her, lowering to his haunches. A large, warm hand settled high on her back. A sideways glance revealed that it was West Ravenel. There were no glib comments, only a calm, friendly quietness that soothed her. His touch reminded her a little of the way Ethan would sometimes stroke or gently grip the nape of her neck. She began to relax, the tremors fading. He stayed like that, the pressure of his hand light and comforting, until she let out a shuddering sigh and sat up. Ravenel's hands slid away. Wordlessly he gave her a glass filled with a small portion of whiskey or brandy, something alcoholic, and she took it gratefully. Her teeth clattered against the edge of the glass as she took a swallow. The smooth amber fire helped to drain a few last shudders of nervous tension.
"It's been almost an hour," Ravenel said. "The transfusion was successful, wasn't it?"
Garrett drank again. "He won't die from the damage done by the bullet," she said dully, her fingers clutched around the glass. "He'll die from what was allowed inside by the bullet track. Viruses, bacteria, lethal microbes, chemical contaminants. I'd rather have immersed him in poison than that river. The Thames would turn up Neptune himself within 5 minutes."
"I wouldn't say death is a foregone conclusion," Ravenel said. "It comes from tough stock, a long line of vicious bastards. As he's already proven, he can survive things other men wouldn't."
"You're acquainted with his family?" she asked.
"He hasn't told you, then? The Ravenels are his family. His father was the old Earl. If Ransom hadn't been born a bastard, he would be Lord Trinneer right now, instead of my brother."
Chapter 17 West smiled slightly as Garrett Gibson stared at him with dazed green eyes.
"That explains the resemblance," she said, after a long moment.
How very small she seemed, tucked in a corner of the library with her knees drawn up. For the past hour and a half she had been a commanding figure, strung tight with energy, her gaze stern and steely. She had worked in millimetres, doing tiny, crucial things to veins and cellular tissue with astonishing precision. Although West knew nothing about surgery, he'd understood that he was witnessing someone perform with rare skill. Now, in her exhaustion, the brilliant surgeon resembled an anxious schoolgirl who had taken a wrong turn on the way home. West liked her a great deal. In fact, he was rather sorry now that he'd kept shrugging off Helen's efforts to introduce them. He'd envisaged the female doctor as a severe matron, probably hostile toward men, and Helen's assurances that Dr. Gibson was quite pretty hadn't been at all convincing. Helen, with her completely unjustified affection for humanity, loved to overestimate people. But Garrett Gibson was more than pretty. She was riveting. An intelligent, accomplished woman with an elusive quality, a suggestion of hidden tenderness that intrigued him. The evening had been one surprise after another, starting with Ethan Ransom being carried in half-dead by a pair of terrified river police, who clearly wanted nothing to do with the affair. Having stopped their patrol boat beneath Blackfriars Bridge for a forbidden drink of whiskey from a flask, the officers could hear the murder in progress above them. After the assassin had left the bridge, they'd managed to haul the wounded man aboard and searched his pockets, and had found nothing to identify him other than West's calling card. But they'd had enough to realise that reporting the matter would result in more trouble than they cared to deal with. "Who did this?" West had asked Ransom as he lay in a filthy, crumpled heap on the settee.
"One of Jenkins' men,"
Ransom had gasped, fighting to stay conscious, his eyes unfocused.
"Jenkins ordered it?"
"Yes, don't trust police. Felbrick, when they find me..."
"They won't find you."
"They'll come."
Let them try, West had thought, livid, as he saw what had been done to his kinsman. Kathleen had bent over the dying man, using a soft white cloth to wipe some of the grime from his face. Ransom lost consciousness for several seconds, and reawakened with a groan.
"May I send for someone?"
she had asked gently, and he'd responded with a string of nearly unintelligible words that she somehow managed to make sense of. She had turned to West with a perplexed and sorrowing look.
"He wants Dr. Gibson."
"Gibson's in King's Cross, isn't she? We can fetch our family physician far more quickly."
"He doesn't want her as a doctor," Kathleen had said softly. "He wants the woman he loves."
It had struck West as a highly improbable pairing, the doctor and the government agent. But after seeing them together, he realised their connection didn't have to be understood by anyone except the two of them. Rising to his feet and looking down at Garrett's strained face, West saw that she'd nearly reached the breaking point. She stared back at him vacantly, too drained and overwhelmed to ask a single question.
"Doctor," he said gently, "I've just spoken to my brother, who's arranged for us to take Ransom to Hampshire. We're leaving in a few hours."
"He can't be moved. He's not safe here. No one else is either. There's no choice."
Garrett snapped back to attention, her gaze sharpening. "All the jolting could kill him. It's out of the question. I swear to you he'll be conveyed quickly and carefully."
"On rough country roads?" she asked scornfully. "We're transporting him by private train carriage. We'll reach the family estate by dawn. It's quiet and secluded there. He'll be able to heal in privacy."
West could hardly wait to return to Eversby Priory. He was beginning to hate London and its hard-hearted chaos of streets, buildings, vehicles and trains, filth, smoke, glitter and grandeur. Oh, he missed the city from time to time, but after a few days he was always eager to get back to Hampshire. The Ravenel's ancient manor house was positioned on a hill, from which anyone who approached could be seen for miles. The estate's tens of thousands of acres had belonged to the family since the days of William the Conqueror. It seemed appropriate that Ethan Ransom, who, although illegitimate, was in the family's direct line of descent, should be guarded from his enemies in the home of his ancestors.
He and Garrett Gibson would be safe there. West would make sure of it. Garrett was shaking her head.
I can't leave my father. He's old and ill.
We'll take him with us. Now, tell me what Ransom will need for the journey. West was fairly certain that, in ordinary circumstances, Garrett would have argued over the plan. But she looked at him dumbly, seeming paralysed.
If you don't wish to come with us, he said after a moment, I'll hire a nurse for Ransom.
That might be for the best, actually. You can remain in London and maintain appearances. Well, we'll need an ambulance cart from the clinic to convey him from here to the station. Garrett interrupted with a scowl. As well as from the Hampshire station to your home. We'll have to take it with us.
An entire cart?
West asked, wondering how they could fit that onto the train carriage.
Can't we make do with a stretcher and a good mattress?
The cart's framework is fitted with special elastic springs to absorb jolts. Otherwise, the artery ligations won't hold and he'll hemorrhage. We'll also need portable water tanks, an icebox, hand lanterns, pails, basins, linens, toweling.
Write it all down, West said hastily.
We'll also have to take my cookmaid with us to look after my father.
Whatever you need.
Her green eyes narrowed. Why are you doing this? Mr. Ransom doesn't like the Ravenels. The very name makes him hostile.
That's because Edmund, the old Earl, treated both Ransom and his mother quite badly.
West rolled up his loose shirt sleeve and began to pick at the strip of adhesive plaster Garrett had affixed over the puncture left by the hollow needle. It had stopped bleeding by now, and the bandage was beginning to itch.
I'm willing to help Ransom because, in the past, he was kind to Helen and Pandora. Also because, whether he likes it or not, he's a Ravenel, and there are damn few of us left. My brother and I were orphaned when we were young, and deep down I've always harboured idiotic fantasies of large family dinners and children and dogs running through the house.
I doubt Mr. Ransom would want any part of that.
Perhaps not. But we men aren't quite as simplistic as we appear. A bullet in the chest could inspire a man to reconsider his options.
Garrett was only vaguely aware of the whirlwind of preparations taking place around her. She stayed with Ethan in the Ravenel's formerly elegant library, now a wreckage of sodden, soiled upholstery and stained carpeting. The situation now appeared to be beyond her control. Lord Tranier and West Ravenel were making decisions without her, and she was too weary to try and insert herself into the process. Ethan gradually awakened from the surgery in great pain, disoriented and wretchedly ill from the effects of anaesthesia and the toxic after-effects of the Thames. He barely seemed to recognise Garrett, and answered questions only in monosyllables. She did what she could to ease his misery, giving him another injection of morphine, bathing his face with cool water, and sliding a small pillow beneath his head. Sitting at the table, she lowered her head to her folded arms. For a moment, she shut her eyes and felt herself sinking into sleep. "Doctor," came Kathleen's gentle voice. Garrett jerked her head up, trying to collect herself.
"How are you feeling, my lady?"
"Much better, thank you. We've sent two of the servants to help your cookmaid pack for herself and your father. Lord Tranier and I have a proposition we would like you to consider."
"Yes?"
"We had already planned to leave town for the summer, but before retreating to Eversby Priory, we had accepted an invitation to spend a fortnight in Sussex with Pandora's in-laws, the Duke and Duchess of Kingston. They have a lovely seaside manor with a private sandy cove and ample room for guests. I think it would do your father some good to come with us, and perhaps take some seawater baths and do a bit of sunning. That way you'll only have to concern yourself with nursing Mr. Ransom back to health, instead of having your attention divided."
"My lady, I could never impose on you that way, not to mention the Duke and Duchess.
After the way you saved Pandora's life, they would be delighted to welcome your father. He would be treated like royalty."
Rubbing her sore eyes, Garrett said distractedly,
"He's my responsibility. I don't think there's also the matter of his safety,"
Kathleen pointed out gently.
"If any trouble should arise over Mr. Ransom's presence at Eversby Priory, I'm sure you would prefer your father to be kept out of harm's way."
"Perhaps you're right. I have to ask my father what he would prefer. However, I doubt he'll like the idea of staying with strangers.
Your cookmaid would accompany him, of course."
Kathleen regarded her with a warm, concerned gaze.
"I'll bring him to you as soon as he arrives, and you can discuss it."
"He'll want to go with me," Garrett said. "I'm all he has."
But when Stanley Gibson arrived at Ravenel House, and the choice before him was laid out, his reaction wasn't exactly what Garrett had expected.
"A holiday at the seashore with a duke?"
her father exclaimed, looking befuddled.
"Me? A man who's never sea-bathed in his life? A constable, hobnobbing with upper-class toffs, eating dinner off gold dishes and drinking fancy French wine?"
"I understand, Papa," Garrett said. "You don't have to."
"By Jove, I'll accept,"
he exclaimed heartily.
"If the Duke wants my company, he shall have it. I suppose it will do him good to spend time with a man like me. Learn a thing or two about my years on the beat."
"Papa," Garrett began in muted alarm, "I don't think the Duke specifically requested..."
"Oh, settle then,"
Eliza broke in hastily.
"Wouldn't do to disappoint a Duke, would it? You and I will have to brace up and go to Sussex, Mr. Gibson, to humour his grace."
"Do what you can for other people," Mum always says. "Come now, the housekeeper has a room for you to rest in till we leave for our train in the morning." Before Garrett could utter a word of protest, the pair had bustled out of the library. With a speed and efficiency that was nothing short of miraculous, the Ravenels had acquired every item on Garrett's list before dawn. Ethan was carefully strapped into a stretcher, which was carried out by a pair of footmen and the Earl himself, to the waiting ambulance cart behind the mews. The sky was unrelieved black, the only light coming from street lamps that cast crooked shadows across the pavement. Sitting beside Ethan in the covered cart, Garrett could see very little of their route or direction. West had told her that they were going to a private railway station just south of London, where they would board a special train without being observed and bypass the usual permissions and restrictions. Extra precautions had been taken for guarding crossings and securing facing points, which would be timed to allow the train to run without stoppages. A single horse pulled the ambulance cart at a measured pace. Despite the vehicle's shock-absorbing springs, Ethan was jostled and jarred until stifled groans escaped him. Unable to imagine what hell he was enduring, Garrett held his hand, not letting go, even when his grip turned bone-crushingly tight. The cart slowed as they came to a place so dark and quiet that it seemed as if they had entered some remote forest. Peeking beneath the hem of the cart's canvas covering, Garrett saw towering gates covered with ivy and ghostly sculptures of angels and solemn figures of men, women, and children with their arms crossed in resignation upon their breasts. Graveyard sculptures. A stab of horror went through her, and she crawled to the front of the cart to where West Ravenel was sitting with the driver.
"Where the devil are you taking us, Mr. Ravenel?"
He glanced at her over his shoulder, his brows raised.
"I told you before, a private railway station.
It looks like a cemetery."
"It's a cemetery station," he admitted, "with a dedicated line that runs funeral trains out to burial grounds. It also happens to connect to the main lines and branches of the London Ironstone Railroad, owned by our mutual friend, Tom Severin."
"You told Mr. Severin about all this? Dear God! Can we trust him?"
West grimaced slightly. "One never wants to be in the position of having to trust Severin," he admitted. "But he's the only one who could obtain clearances for a special train so quickly."
They approached a massive brick and stone building housing a railway platform. A ponderous stone sign adorned the top of the carriage entrance, Silent Gardens. Just below it, the shape of an open book emblazoned with words had been carved in the stone, Ad Meliora. "Toward better things," Garrett translated beneath her breath. West looked back at her in surprise.
"You studied Latin?"
She sent him a sardonic glance. "I'm a doctor." A quick apologetic grin crossed his face.
"Of course."
The ambulance cart came to a halt at the platform, where the Ravenel carriage and two other vehicles were already parked. The instant the brake was applied, footmen and a pair of porters rushed forward to begin the process of removing the stretcher from the vehicle.
"Be careful,"
Garrett said sharply.
"I'll manage them," West told her, "while you board the train carriage."
"If they bump or jar him..." "Yes, I understand. Let me handle it." Frowning, Garrett descended from the cart and took in her surroundings. A reverse-painted glass sign beside the door listed the contents of each floor. Mortuary rooms, crypts, storerooms, and third-class waiting rooms on the basement level. Chapel, robing rooms, and second-class waiting rooms on the main level.
and offices and first-class waiting rooms on the upper levels. A second sign instructed mourners as to which funeral carriages on the train were designated for first-class coffins, and which ones were for second and third class. Staring more closely at the sign, Garrett gave a bemused shake of her head at the discovery that corpses on the train were divided into social classes, just as living passengers were. To a doctor, however, there were no class divisions between one unclothed body and another, whether living or dead. Every man, rich or poor, was alike in his natural state. An amused male voice with a Welsh accent broke into her thoughts.
Aye, even a corpse must know its place.
Garrett turned quickly. Mr. Winterbourne, she exclaimed. No one told me to expect you. I'm so sorry to have troubled you. Her employer smiled down at her. Little reflected lights from nearby gas lamps gleamed in his dark eyes.
No trouble, Doctor. This is close to the time I rise every morning. I wanted to make sure the train carriage was stocked and ready for you.
Her eyes widened. It's your train carriage?
The passenger carriage is mine, but the locomotive and extra rolling stock belong to Tom Severin.
Sir, I'm indebted to you more than I can say.
Not at all. Lady Helen and I consider you one of the family. Helen sent her love, by the way.
Winterbourne hesitated, his gaze chasing restlessly around the platform before returning to hers.
I was told about Havelock's refusal to assist in the surgery. For what it's worth, his decision doesn't sit well with me.
Please don't blame him.
You don't?
Garrett shook her head. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, she quoted with a grim smile. A true friend will tell you when he thinks you're making a mistake.
A true friend will be making the mistake with you, Winterbourne said dryly. As it happens, I don't agree that you did anything wrong. Had I been put in your place, I would have made the same choice.
You would?
If there were any chance of saving someone I loved, I'd take care of me damn to anyone who stood in my way.
Looking her over, Winterbourne said frankly, You're at the length of your tether.
There are two staterooms in the train carriage. Try to steal a few minutes of rest before you reach Hampshire.
He reached into his coat and withdrew a weighty leather envelope. Take this. Cautiously, Garrett peeked inside the pouch, which was stuffed with £100 notes. It was more cash money than she'd ever held in her life. Mr. Winterbourne, I couldn't possibly...
Money doesn't solve every problem, he said, but it never hurts. Send for me if there's anything you need. When Ransom's condition improves, let me know.
Yes, sir. Thank you. As Winterbourne escorted her onto the train, they passed a crew of shopmen busily removing the wheels of the ambulance cart to make its transport easier. The stretcher had already been conveyed onto the railway carriage, which was a virtual palace on wheels. It had two staterooms, each with its own connected toilet room, equipped with hot and cold running water, an observation room, and a parlour with movable velvet-coloured chairs and reading lamps. Winterbourne's carpenters had devised a suspension of the stretcher on cross supports, attached to the wall with heavy metal spring hooks. Garrett winced briefly as she saw that the hooks had been bolted directly onto the carriage's beautiful, quartered English oak woodwork. However, the arrangement would work well to minimise shocks and jolts once the train started moving. After the stretcher was settled into its makeshift berth, Garrett pushed a chair to the place beside it. She laid her palm tenderly across Ethan's forehead, which was dry and hot to the touch, and took up his wrist to check his pulse. He was flushed and restless, his breath fitful. Coming to stand at the other side of the wounded man, Winterbourne regarded him with a deep frown of concern.
"You always seemed indestructible," he said quietly. "He's made powerful enemies. I don't like it that you're in the crosswires with him."
"He didn't like it either. He tried to keep a distance between us."
Winterbourne looked sardonic. "Not hard enough, it seems."
Garrett smiled faintly. "I made it difficult for him. I can be stubborn at times."
"I've noticed."
But Winterbourne's gaze was kind. Staring down at Ethan's face, Garrett said, "He expected from the beginning that it would come to this.
He thought there was no other possible path for his life to take.
Perhaps you should prove